Hello, hello, hello. This is Henry Rollins, and you are listening to KORC 105.9 LPFM, servicing Corvallis, Oregon, streaming worldwide at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Tuesday, November 12th at 6:30 p.m., the Historic Resources Commission will be meeting in person as well as virtually. The in-person meeting will be at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, November 13th at 10 a.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board will be meeting virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting. Also on Wednesday, November 13th, but at 4:30 p.m., the Parks and Recreation Operational Advisory Committee will be meeting virtually and in person. For details on how to join online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. The in-person meeting will be held at the Willow Room in the Corvallis Community Center, 2601 Northwest Tyler Avenue. Lastly, on Wednesday, November 13th at 5:30 p.m., the City Budget Commission will be meeting in person and virtually. The in-person meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
Greetings, listeners. This is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics. Today on the Corvallis Civics Cafe, our menu has an hors d'oeuvre of a review of the City Council election results. Then we will have a main course of items discussed at last week's City Council meetings, seasoned with some spicy sauce about parking in downtown. And for dessert, we will have a What's Coming Up Next in November for City Meetings. About the local elections, as I stated last week, the local scene promises positive change, and I'm pleased to say that yes, there are changes coming to the Corvallis City Council in 2025. Jan Napak retained her seat in Ward 1, as did Bria Lewis in Ward 2. Ward 3's Jim Moorfield will take over the seat from Hyatt Lytle, and in Ward 4, Ava Olson will step into the space being vacated by Gabe Shepard, who is moving on up to a seat at the table as a Benton County Commissioner. Ward 5 is happy to retain Charlyn Ellis, and perhaps now our city government will resolve the lawsuit. Ahem. How about that? Moving on to the two wards that each had three candidates, Allison Bowden will represent Ward 6, and Paul Schaefer will continue for Ward 7. Ward 8 has welcomed new council member Carolyn Myers in place of Tracy Yee, and last but not least, Ward 9 re-elected Tony Cadena in our closest race of the year. At this point in time, the official results show more than 48% of the votes in Ward 9 went to the challenger, Karen Jean Kanan. Corvallis City Council races are nonpartisan, but that does not stop political alignments from developing amongst the members of the council, and with new additions to the council, new alignments will form. If the new council members stay true to their campaign pledges and the incumbents stay true to their past positions, it is likely that the councilors for Wards 1 and 9 will continue to vote along one alignment, and those in Wards 2, 5, and 7 will be joined by the new voices for Wards 3, 4, and 6. Only time will tell how the votes from Ward 8 will align. I hope y'all stay tuned to my coverage here on KORC's News, Music, and Civics, because 2025 could be a very expensive year for the residents of Corvallis, and these expenses will be determined by votes of the members of the City Council. That seems like a great place to segue into our main course. What happened at city-related meetings last week? To recap the week, on 4th of November, City Council held their regular Monday night meeting. On Wednesday, November 6th, there were meetings of the Planning Commission and the Library Advisory Board. On Thursday the 7th, the Downtown Parking Task Force met in the morning, and in the afternoon, the City Council had a work session. Information about meetings, including meeting materials, meeting minutes, and links to the recordings of the meetings can be found on the city website at www.corvallisoregon.gov. My attention was focused on those two meetings of the City Council, because the City Council is being heavily pressured to make decisions about the Civic Campus on a short timeline. With less than 2 months remaining in the year, the timeline has the current members of the Council making a decision about the design options as soon as December 2nd. On November 7th, the council was presented with four design alternatives for the Civic Campus and police facilities. Next, on November 21st, they are scheduled to discuss the final report and recommendations of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force. But wait, why are they discussing the task force report after seeing the design options for the facilities? How is it that the four design alternatives were presented prior to the discussion of the community's feedback about the idea of the project? Why this timeline? Where in those 2 weeks will there be time to modify one of the four current alternatives should the council choose to incorporate the community feedback? Is the community input being heard for the sake of hearing it, or for the chance that it might influence the outcome of the project? Because it is our money that will be used to pay for these facilities, and the current price tag ranges from as low as $190 million or as much as $240 million. That's millions, as in dollars. And before we spend that kind of money, even for things that we have decided we need, input from the public ought to be located on a timeline that gives us some indication that it has been considered. But back to that meeting. On Thursday, at the two-hour work session, the members of the council heard from the city manager, from special consultant Mary Steckel, from representatives of the FFA architecture firm, and from the heads of key city departments, such as the police department, the planning department, and the IT department, all of which currently function inside physical spaces that no longer meet the needs of their staff or the community. There was what amounted to a full court press regarding the deplorable state of some of our key city buildings. To be fair, the state of many of our buildings is indeed poor. Detailed information can be found at CorvallisOregon.gov, and this has been discussed at many city meetings. But, and this should be a loud and resounding but, the voices of the people need to be heard and considered, not cataloged and filed. The Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force report clearly stated the following: that the council should consider decoupling the building of a police facility from the building of a civic administration building, that the city administration buildings should remain downtown, and that many residents are critically worried about the burden of paying for these facilities. Which conveniently leads me to a spicy, saucy discussion on parking. At the Thursday work session, of the design alternatives, one included a $55 million parking structure. Wait, isn't the city currently awaiting feedback from the Downtown Parking Task Force about how best to manage parking in the downtown core? Would it not be prudent to receive that feedback prior to making any decisions about spending $55 million taxpayer dollars on a parking structure? We cannot build flush toilets in Central Park, and we struggle to fill potholes on our streets. We cannot shelter all of our unsheltered residents, and the city pool has an unsound roof. But maybe we can find $55 million to build a parking structure we might not need. Wait, don't we need a new sewage treatment plant? I'm not sure how we find the money to pay for all of these things, but my priorities lie with water treatment and maintaining the infrastructure we already have, not adding to our maintenance burden by building a parking structure over our downtown transit center, which, by the way, would kill any possibility of using the current transit space to expand bus service. And if we had a more robust transit system, more people might use it to access downtown, thus driving down the demand for parking. And wait, what about the city's climate goals? How do we meet those by pouring tons and tons of new cement into a parking garage? Whew, that got spicy. Let's move on. Let's close out with a look at what city meetings are coming up next week. Tuesday the 12th, it's coffee with your economic development office from 10 to 11 a.m. at Sam Station, located at 1210 Northwest 29th Street. Also on Tuesday, there's a meeting of the Historic Resources Commission at 6:30 p.m. That meeting takes place live at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room or virtually via Zoom. Wednesday the 13th, there are three meetings. The Climate Action Advisory Board's Decarbonization Workgroup will hold a virtual-only meeting from 10 to 11:30 a.m. via Zoom. The Parks and Recreation Operational Advisory Committee meeting will be at 4:30 p.m. and takes place in person at the Corvallis Community Center's Oak Room with a virtual option via Zoom. And also on the 13th, the City Budget Commission has a meeting at 5:30 p.m., which can be attended in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room or virtually via Zoom. If all of this talk about the City of Corvallis has stirred your desire to participate, know that there is space open on the Planning Commission. For more details, visit www.corvallisoregon.gov/advisorygroups corvallis-pc. Thanks for joining me here at the Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have comments or feedback, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2, and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. We archive our programs at our website, korcfm.com. This past week, the U.S. held its national election, with Donald Trump emerging as the victor of the antiquated Electoral College vote, as well as the popular vote. This was an unexpected win for many, and as the opposing political party picks up the pieces and speculates on what went wrong, there are voices on the edge of the mainstream with insight that may not make it into the corporate media narrative or the Democratic Party echo chamber. Jason Hickel is an anthropologist and professor at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. His research and writing focuses on economic anthropology and development, and is particularly opposed to capitalism, neocolonialism, and he also forsakes the idea of economic growth as a measure of human development. After the results of the election this last week, he stated online, "Yes, it was insane for the Democrats to think they could win by running a soulless candidate without a shred of progressive policy vision, pursuing endorsements from neocon war hawks everybody hates, while arming and funding a genocide and belittling and crushing those who have enough morality to protest it. It is enraging that the Democrats are so smug and blind to this. But these are all just symptoms," he goes on to say. "The deeper reality is that liberalism has failed. Liberalism is dead. And people urgently need to wake up to this fact and respond accordingly. It is a defunct ideology that cannot offer any meaningful solutions to our social and ecological crises, and it must be abandoned. Democrats have proven over and over again that they cannot accept even basic steps like public health care, affordable housing, and a public job guarantee, things that would dramatically improve the material, social, and political conditions of the working class. And they cannot accept a public finance strategy that would steer production away from fossil fuels and toward green transition to give us a shot at a livable future. Why? Because these things run against the objectives of capital accumulation. And for liberals, capital is sacrosanct. They will do whatever it takes to ensure elite accumulation. It is their only consistent commitment. At home, they suppress and demonize progressive and socialist tendencies. Abroad, they engage in endless wars and violence to suppress input prices in the global South and prevent any possibility of sovereign economic development. The Democrats have done all this purposefully and knowingly for my whole life," Jason states, "not as some kind of mistake, but in full consciousness that it is in the interests of capital. And because liberalism cannot address our crises, and because it crushes socialist alternatives, it inevitably paves the way for right-wing populism. They know this pattern, and yet they risk it every time, this election being only the most recent example. They did it in 2016, when they actively crushed the Sanders campaign and sent Trump to the White House. They do it because ultimately they, and I mean the liberal ruling class here, don't really mind if fascists take power, so long as the latter too ensure the conditions for capital accumulation. They 100% prefer this to the possibility of a socialist alternative. So progressives have to face reality. The dream of converting the Democratic Party is dead. This is now a fact, and it must be accepted. The only option is to build a mass-based movement that can reclaim the working classes and mobilize a political vehicle that can integrate disparate progressive struggles into a unified and formidable political force and achieve substantive transformation. This will take real work, actual organizing, but it must be done, and that process must begin now. Those are the words of Jason Hickel, an anthropologist and professor at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. This is a recording of presidential candidate Claudia de la Cruz. She ran in this past presidential election as the candidate for the Party of Socialism and Liberation.
So Trump resoundingly won both the popular vote and the Electoral College. And Trump's agenda is clearly hateful. It is dangerous and will have significant impacts on working class people. So they are definitely not the ones to lead us. But let's be clear, the Democrats are responsible for losing and have no one else to blame but themselves. This is not the collapse of Harris, but of the Democratic Party's agenda, a collapse of the neoliberal, pro-war, pro-corporate politics that does not offer solutions to working class people. Ever since Bernie Sanders, the party has crushed all proposals to support progressive movements and workers and poor people in this country. The Democratic Party has abandoned and betrayed the working class. And as expected, the working class has abandoned the Democratic Party. We can't blame the people. We must blame the ones who have the economic and political power to change things and have chosen not to respond to people's needs. That's what this is about. The results of this election does not mean people have become more racist or more fascist. It means that Democrats have failed at fighting for or defending the people. It's been a period of stagnant wages, no real relief on childcare or rent or food prices, broken promises from 2020, setting high expectations and then failing to deliver. There are consequences for all of that. This election showed that the Democrats would rather fund endless wars and hand over the country to the Republicans than to allow progressive voices of the working class to be heard. So with Democrats presenting a defeated spirit and with Republicans in charge, what is left for working class people? Socialism is the only force that can defeat the far right, and we must continue to work of our fight back campaigns, take the streets and move millions into action that will require our political clarity, our courage, and the determination to fight and win. Only the people will save the people. And we need to build our own movement of working class people. We need to build our own independent political organization by and for the working class that's ready to take power. That is why we invite you to join the PSL. Visit pslweb.org and join the movement to fight back.
That was the words of presidential candidate Claudia de la Cruz. She ran in this past election as the candidate for the Party of Socialism and Liberation. The aforementioned Bernie Sanders also sent a letter to his supporters, the beginning of which was excerpted on certain social media pages. This is the entirety of his post-election reaction. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people would find that the working class has abandoned them. First, it was the white working class, and now it is Latino and black workers as well. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change. And they're right. Today, while the very rich are doing phenomenally well, 60% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, and we have more income and wealth inequality than ever before. Unbelievable, real inflation accounted for weekly wages for the average American worker are actually lower now than they were 50 years ago. Today, despite an explosion in technology and worker productivity, many young people will have a worse standard of living than their parents. And many of them worry that artificial intelligence and robotics will make a bad situation even worse. Today, despite spending far more per capita than other countries, we remain the only wealthy nation not to guarantee health care to all as a human right, and we pay, by far, the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We, alone among major countries, cannot even guarantee paid family and medical leave. Today, despite strong opposition from a majority of Americans, we continue to spend billions funding the extremist Netanyahu government's all-out war against the Palestinian people, which has led to the horrific humanitarian disaster of mass malnutrition and the starvation of thousands of children. Will the big money interests and well-paid consultants who control the Democratic Party learn any real lessons from this disastrous campaign? Will they understand the pain and political alienation that tens of millions of Americans are experiencing? Do they have any idea as to how we can take on the increasingly powerful oligarchy, which has so much economic and political power? Probably not. In the coming weeks and months, those of us concerned about grassroots democracy and economic justice need to have some very serious political discussions. Stay tuned. Those were the words of Bernie Sanders following the election this past week. There are a number of speculations or reasons for the defeat of Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Where we stand now, a candidate who promised his supporters this past July, "In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good, you're not going to have to vote," has taken back the White House. This same candidate has promised retribution on everyone from his running mate, to comedians on television, to federal prosecutors who are now winding down the criminal cases against Trump before his inauguration. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is a segment from Democracy Now!, which aired on Thursday, November 7th, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case.
As Kamala Harris concedes to Donald Trump, we'll look at the roots of Trump's victory. Bernie Sanders blames the Democrats for abandoning the working class.
As soon as I take the oath of office, I'll terminate every open border policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Kamala Harris has conceded the 2024 presidential race to Donald Trump, promising a peaceful transfer of power. Harris addressed supporters Wednesday afternoon at her alma mater, Howard University, after calling Trump to congratulate him.
In our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. This is not a time to throw up our hands.
This is a time to roll up our sleeves.
With millions of ballots still to be counted, Trump is expected to match the 74 million votes he received in 2020. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, won just 68 million votes so far, lagging far behind Joe Biden's performance in 2020 when he got 81 million votes. The vast majority of the 3,000-plus counties across the United States, whether urban, suburban, or rural, swung right in this year's election. Control over the House of Representatives remains up for grabs, with dozens of races yet to be called. So far, Republicans have claimed 206 House seats compared to Democrats' 191. Whichever party reaches 218 will hold the majority and can determine who becomes House Speaker. Meanwhile, Republicans have increased their control over the Senate after winning a majority of seats for the first time since 2020. In Montana, incumbent Democratic Senator John Tester has lost his reelection bid, flipping another Senate seat for Republicans. He was defeated by Tim Sheehy, a former Navy SEAL endorsed by Donald Trump. Sheehy gets an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is strongly anti-abortion. Earlier this year, Montana's Charcuta News published audio clips of Sheehy at campaign events making racist and highly offensive comments about Native Americans. In Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen will hold on to her seat after fending off a challenge from Republican Sam Brown. Rosen's a former synagogue president, first elected to the Senate in 2018. In Michigan, Democratic Congressmember Alyssa Slotkin has narrowly won an open U.S. Senate seat, defeating Republican Mike Rogers. Slotkin's a former Middle East analyst for the CIA who served three terms in Iraq under George W. Bush. She also worked as a high-ranking Pentagon official under President Obama. Puerto Rico's non-voting member of Congress, Republican Jennifer Gonzalez, is set to become the island's next governor. She's a supporter of statehood for Puerto Rico and a Trump supporter. She's on track to narrowly beat Juan Dalmau of the Alianza Coalition. The center-left third-party group made history gains in this year's election, with Puerto Rican voters disaffected with the two main parties. The world's richest person, Elon Musk, saw his net worth soar by over $16 billion Wednesday after Donald Trump secured victory. His net worth is now estimated at $290 billion. Musk personally spent about $120 million helping Trump get elected and used his social media site X, formerly Twitter, to promote Trump's campaign. On Tuesday, Musk wrote, quote, "Men are voting in record numbers. They now realize everything is at stake." Musk was echoing Republican talking points aimed at countering Kamala Harris's support among women and voter dissatisfaction with abortion bans. Trump vowed to install Musk as head of a new government efficiency commission. Musk has proposed cuts of at least $2 trillion to federal spending. Meanwhile, CNN and Politico are reporting Trump has tapped Brian Hook, a top State Department official during the first Trump administration, to begin staffing the State Department. Hook served as special envoy for Iran under Trump, leading the maximum pressure campaign of sanctions, sabotage, and assassinations against Tehran. Special Counsel Jack Smith is reportedly preparing to wind down his two federal criminal cases against Donald Trump in line with Justice Department policy that shields a sitting president from prosecution. Smith charged Trump with election subversion and illegally retaining classified documents. During campaigning, Trump said he would fire Smith within 2 seconds if he was reelected. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers are expected to ask New York Judge Juan Merchan to delay sentencing in Trump's New York hush money and election interference trial. Trump's sentencing on 34 felony counts was postponed earlier this year to November 26th. Georgia's sweeping election subversion case against Trump is also at risk of being delayed due to his reelection. Immigrant communities across the U.S. and asylum seekers near the U.S. border are trying to figure out what an incoming Trump administration will mean for their safety and their rights. This is immigrant rights activist Jose Garcia, who works with asylum seekers in Tijuana.
For us, the concerns here in the north is that the migrant communities will be stuck. However, we will also see many migrants wanting to cross irregularly based on the fact that these aid programs are going to be removed. People will risk more to want to cross irregularly at the various points in our border areas. It is a latent risk where they can be robbed, assaulted, where they can be abandoned to their fate, and in a moment, they can even lose their lives.
We'll have more on immigration later in the broadcast with Stanford professor Ana Raquel Minyan. The Israeli military says Palestinians from northern Gaza will not be allowed to return to their homes, effectively admitting to ethnically cleansing the region. A military official said any future aid to Gaza would only be allowed to enter through the south, but not the north, where there are, quote, no more civilians left, unquote. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Wateridge posted a harrowing video from northern Gaza showing its utter decimation. Wateridge wrote, quote, no matter from what direction you enter, homes, hospitals, schools, health clinics, mosques, apartments, restaurants, all completely flattened. An entire society, now a graveyard, unquote. This comes as the head of UNRWA warned once again the agency will collapse, quote, without intervention by member states. Reuters reports the UN suggested in a letter to Israel that replacing the aid provided by UNRWA would become Israel's responsibility after it recently cut ties with the UN agency. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization resumed large-scale medical evacuations Wednesday, moving over 100 critical patients out of Gaza. Fewer than 300 patients had been able to leave Gaza since Israel blocked the Rafah crossing in May. The WHO estimates up to 14,000 Palestinians are in need of urgent medical evacuation from Gaza. Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed at least 27 Palestinians since the day started, including at least three children in Rafah. In Lebanon, residents of Beirut woke up to smoke-filled skies this morning after a night of Israeli bombardment targeting the capital's southern neighborhoods. This followed deadly Israeli strikes on the eastern Bekaa Valley and the city of Baalbek, which killed at least 40 people and wounded 50 on Wednesday. Hezbollah said it launched a series of attack drones at the Bilu military base south of Tel Aviv in response to the latest attacks. Lebanese residents of Beirut continue to condemn Israel's escalating assault on Lebanon.
This is a savage, predatory enemy that destroys homes, kills people, and kills civilization. It cannot defeat the Hezbollah party. It cannot defeat them with destroying civilizations, with destroying homes, with anything. It cannot defeat them. And I say to Hezbollah, do not stop. Do not stop resisting this enemy. I mean, what is taken away by force must return by force, too.
Meanwhile, Lebanon has filed a complaint at the UN's International Labor Organization over Israel's September terror attack in which 4,000 people were killed or wounded when their pagers suddenly exploded across Lebanon. Russia ratified a mutual defense pact with North Korea Wednesday, solidifying the military alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang. This comes as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of a, quote, new chapter of instability after revealing his troops fought North Korean soldiers on the battlefield for the first time. The combat reportedly took place earlier this week in Russia's Kursk region, though South Korea downplayed the encounter, labeling it an incident involving a small number of fighters. Ukraine says some 11,000 North Korean soldiers are now stationed in Kursk, where Ukraine launched a surprise counterinvasion in August. Germany's governing coalition collapsed Wednesday after Chancellor Olaf Scholz fired his finance minister following failed talks between the three ruling parties. Scholz said he'll remain in office, but called for a confidence vote January 15th, which could lead to fresh elections by the end of March.
I will now very quickly seek a conversation with the opposition leader, Friedrich Merz. I would like to offer him to work constructively together on two issues, or more, which are important for our country, the quick strengthening of our economy and our defense. Our economy can't wait until a snap election takes place.
The Pakistani province of Punjab is asking people to stay home as much as possible, halting in-person schooling and setting up a so-called smog war room in an effort to tackle record levels of air pollution that have choked the region. Hospitals report a spike in patients with respiratory and other smog-related conditions. The air quality index in Lahore recently soared as high as 120 times over recommended levels.
I'm struggling with shortness of breath and watery eyes, likely from poor air quality. I'll stay home until it's safe to venture out.
Government officials say they're investigating ways to mitigate the pollution, including inducing artificial rainfall. This suffocating smog is brought about by a combination of crop burning, vehicular and industrial emissions, and colder air. In Southern California, 14,000 people in Ventura County have been told to evacuate as firefighters battle the fast-moving mountain fire. Nearby, another wildfire, the Broad Fire in Malibu, also erupted Wednesday amidst the dry conditions and strong winds. Forecasters say the rest of the week could bring extremely critical wildfire danger to the region. And Cuba's power grid collapsed again on Wednesday as Hurricane Rafael lashed the island nation with torrential rains and sustained winds of 115 miles per hour. The decades-long U.S.-led embargo on Cuba has left Cuba unable to update its ailing energy infrastructure or import enough fuel and food for its residents. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was the headline segment for Democracy Now! From Thursday, November 7th, 2024. For more information about national and international news, visit democracynow.org. And you're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Well, that was quite a week, wasn't it? This is Lava Lamp Larry, and yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to do a little dissection of the election. Yes, you've heard quite a bit of it. Here's another take. So I want to divide something here between the real issues and what the Republicans won on. The real issues in our life: climate change, gun violence, health care, poverty, racism, and the issues that the Republicans won on: personal grooming, the invasion by immigrants, trans people, the war on Christmas, wokeness. Those are the issues that Republicans voted for in droves. The postmortem blame game has started. It started everywhere. Harris did this or didn't do that, or Biden should have, shouldn't have, whatever. It's bull. This wasn't Harris's fault. She ran a campaign based on reality, while Trump and the GOP in general did a con job on America. And America bought it, lock, stock, and barrel. Because too many of us couldn't face reality and don't want to remember history. The GOP victory was a triumph of illusion. There was the illusion that the economy was better under Trump and worse under Biden. Yes, inflation was real, but it was under control for the most part. There was the illusion that immigrants were a plague on real Americans. They're eating your pets. There was the illusion of white male superiority. There was the illusion that we were once a Christian nation and need to be one again. There was the illusion that there are simple answers to very complex problems. There was the illusion that our sexuality is fixed and binary, and that hyper-masculine incels are somehow God's gift to women. There was the illusion that Trump didn't mean all those things that he was saying or promising to do. All right, but then there's reality. The reality is that this is a very complex world, both technologically and sociologically, and we are not engineered to cope with it. The reality is that the U.S. is rapidly becoming a majority-minority country, and the white Christian male subset that has largely ruled from the beginning, 248 years ago, does not want to share power. The reality is that our strength comes from diversity, and this is unacceptable to those who subscribe to the notion that their way, whatever that is the only way. There's the reality that wealth imbalance has gotten so out of hand that billionaires who inherited their wealth or stole it now believe, and have convinced others to believe, that their wealth gives them special insight, special knowledge of what's best for all of us. There's the reality that science has, however clumsily and inefficiently, made our lives better, even if it came with the cost of demolishing long-cherished beliefs. There's the reality of global climate change. There's the reality of abortion. There's the reality that Putin wants to rule as much of the world as he can. There's the reality that the world is overpopulated and cannot long sustain this drain on its resources. There's the reality that human sexuality is complicated. None of that mattered. This is who we are now, slaves to our illusions and ultimately victims of our illusions. Reality always wins in the end. And the harder the world resists and denies reality, the worse it will be when reality finally hits home. My opinion, I'm Lava Lamp Larry for KORC News.
You're listening to KORC. The following excerpt is a segment from the Archive of Desire, a festival inspired by C.P. Kavafis, celebrating the Greek poet's 160th anniversary, which occurred in April through June of 2023. You're going to hear a reading by artist Laurie Anderson of Kavafis' 1898 poem, Waiting for the Barbarians, a dystopian view about pending doom and the end of civilization, as he saw it. It takes the perspective of two individuals, one who's called the naive speaker and the other the more worldly speaker, talking about the impending arrival of the quote-unquote barbarians.
No, I chose these two poems because they're both about expectations. And the first one, set in ancient Rome, and the government has come to a standstill. Everybody's arguing. It's basically a deadlock, a shutdown. And I thought, hang on, this sounds familiar. And they all seem to be waiting for someone, these strangers, or maybe some kind of enemy to show up. So they're hanging around, waiting, trying to figure things out. And then there is a kind of a surprise ending. What are we waiting for? Assembled in the forum. The barbarians are here today. And why isn't anything going on in the Senate? And why are the senators just sitting there without legislating? Because the barbarians are coming today.
The barbarians are coming, the barbarians are coming, the barbarians are coming today.
Yeah, the barbarians are coming today. So what's the point of coming, waiting for senators to make laws now? Once the barbarians are here, they'll do the legislating. Did our emperor get up so early? And why is he sitting enthroned at the city's main gate? City's main gate. In state, wearing the crown. Because the barbarians are coming today. Give him loaded with titles, imposing names. And why have our two consuls and praetors come out today wearing their embroidered, their scarlet togas? And why have they put on their bracelets with so many amethysts? Rings sparkling with magnificent emeralds. And why are they carrying elegant canes, beautifully worked in silver and gold?
Silver and gold.
Because the barbarians are coming today. And things like that just dazzle the barbarians. Distinguished orators turn up as usual to make their speeches and say what they have to say, say what they have to say, because the barbarians are coming today. They're bored by rhetoric and public speaking. Everyone going home, lost in thought. Why this confusion, this bewilderment? There are no barbarians anymore. Those people were a kind of solution. Unless we ourselves, unless we ourselves are the barbarians, unless we ourselves are the barbarians. And as you set out for Ithaca, hope your road is a long one, full of adventure. Full of discovery. Lestragonians, Cyclops, angry Poseidon. Don't be afraid of them. You won't see them if your thoughts are somewhere else. Always keep Ithaca in your mind. Arriving there is something you're destined for. And hope your road is a long one. May there be many summer mornings when, with what pleasure, what joy, you enter harbors you're seeing for the very first time. May you buy fine things, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony. Sensual perfumes of every kind. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to learn from their scholars. And always keep Ithaca in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for. But don't hurry the journey at all. It's better if it lasts for years. You think it gave you a marvelous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out. She gave you everything, nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you'll have understood by then. What these Ithacas mean. So if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you'll have understood by then. What these Ithacas mean.
Was musician, composer, artist Laurie Anderson, along with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus and music performed by The Knights, in her reading of C.P. Kapaveas's Waiting for the Barbarians, a dystopian view of the end of civilization and the arrival of the quote-unquote barbarians. You're listening to KORC.
Thanks for joining us today on KORC News, Music, and Civics. The program is every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. It repeats 5 to 6 p.m. on Mondays, and you can check out an archive of past shows by visiting KORCFM.com. Click on News, you will find our archive. And if you would like to be a part of what we are doing with this effort, getting the public voices, local voices on the air, bringing the community together in whatever ways we can, presenting factual, timely, and relevant information. It's a collective effort, and we invite you to reach out if you'd like to help us out. You can send an email to info@korcfm.com or news@korcfm.com. We hope you can join us next week for another edition of KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. Have a good rest of your afternoon or evening.